NPR's business news starts with new rules for buying banks. This story is a reminder that whenever somebody is losing money, somebody else may be able to make it. A failing bank can be an object of desire for those private equity investment firms, those giant funds that buy up troubled companies, try to turn them around, sell them again for a profit. Private equity firms are now sniffing around the banking landscape for opportunities, but they've come up against resistance from bank regulators. Yesterday, a top bank watchdog, the Federal Deposit Insurance Corporation, came out with some new guidelines for how private equity firms could take over banks. From member station WNYC, Lisa Chow has more on the growing role of these investors in our economy.
More than 80 banks have closed so far this year. That's the most since the height of the savings and loan crisis in the 1990s. The growing number has drained the FDIC's insurance fund, so the regulator is looking for a way to drum up some cash, or better, find buyers for these banks. Here enters private equity, an industry that in recent years has gotten a bad reputation. Critics say it takes too many risks, and its managers charge huge fees. But private equity funds have what many banks now need.
Private equity firms today, on a worldwide basis, have close to $500 billion ready to invest.
Doug Lowenstein is president of the Private Equity Council, a key lobbying group for the industry.
And it seems to us that some of that capital can and should find a home and helping to recapitalize the banking sector, which is starved for capital.
Lowenstein says pairing private equity with troubled banks makes a lot of sense, beyond the money issue. Many private equity funds specialize in buying struggling companies and making them profitable. For example, in 1992, the private equity firm Thomas Lee bought Snapple for $135 million, built up the brand, and then 2 years later sold it to Quaker Oats for more than 12 times as much, $1.7 billion.
Snapple was a company which put tea in a bottle and sold it, which doesn't seem like rocket science.
Josh Lerner is a professor at Harvard Business School and an expert in private equity.
When Thomas Lee basically came and bought a controlling interest in the company, they did a wide variety of things in terms of both increasing the sophistication of the management, putting in resources for marketing and other endeavors. It was also a situation where the company itself grew considerably in terms of sales, profits, and employment during the time that the private equity group owned it.
But Lerner says there have also been spectacular failures. The private equity firm Cerberus bought Chrysler for more than $7 billion in 2007. The car company this year filed for bankruptcy. Among the industry's critics are organized labor and community activists who accuse private equity of only looking for a quick profit. Dan Cantor is executive director of Working Families, a political party in New York State.
They have not shown an interest in serving the public good, and they have a record of stripping assets for their own enrichment.
Wilbur Ross is a private investor. He defended his industry, saying profits are shared by all fund investors, including public and private pension funds.
It isn't like a couple of fat cats are simply dividing up whatever profits get made. It really goes into the retirement funds of the average Americans.
Ross is gearing up for the new opportunities. He bought a failed bank in Florida last May and plans to buy more. But it's still not clear how many other private investors will jump into this market and whether banks purchased by private equity firms will recover. For NPR News, I'm Lisa Chow in New York.
From NPR News, this is All Things Considered. I'm Robert Siegel.
And I'm Melissa Block. The government fund that protects most bank deposits is running low on cash. The Federal Deposit Insurance Corporation announced today that its funds have dwindled to just $10.4 billion. They haven't been that low in more than 15 years. The trouble is, the economy may be looking up, but many banks are still struggling. And the FDIC's list of problem banks has grown to more than 400 since spring. NPR's Frank Langfitt reports.
81 banks have failed so far this year. At a news conference, FDIC Chair Sheila Bair said those failures are sapping its insurance fund. The fund is now at its lowest level since 1993, and Bair said more bank failures are coming.
We expect the numbers of problem banks and failures will remain elevated, even as the economy begins to recover.
The fund insures deposits of up to $250,000. Bear emphasized that depositors aren't at risk.
No insured depositor has ever lost a penny of insured deposits, and no one ever will.
But Bear said the fund definitely needs more money. She said she has no plans to borrow from the Treasury. Instead, she expects the FDIC to levy a special assessment on banks to raise the money later this year. Why are so many banks in trouble at a time when the economy may be bottoming out? Analysts say it's delayed impact from the recession.
Banks are just, you know, a mirror reflection of the economy overall.
That's Guy Sakala. He publishes Inside Mortgage Finance. The financial crisis began with the collapse of the housing market. Now, Sakala says, the problems affecting banks are broader and more rooted in the real economy. Securities on commercial mortgages are souring, and Sakala says mounting job losses and business bankruptcies are causing more people to default on loans.
You tend to see the direct impact of the unemployment on consumer loans, you know, credit cards, auto loans, that type of thing. The companies that are laying off people often have losses themselves, and they are defaulting on loans. And, you know, again, it has a domino effect.
And continues to batter bank balance sheets. The FDIC added more than 100 banks to its problem list between April and June. Sakala says the insurance fund clearly needs to be replenished.
$10.4 billion is not a big number. You know, basically, a fairly mid-size bank could wipe that out very soon.
But bankers say hitting them up for more money in this economy has consequences. Michael Menzies runs Easton Bank and Trust on Maryland's Eastern Shore. He also chairs the Independent Community Bankers of America.
Depends on the dollar amount, obviously, and whatever that dollar amount is, it will reduce our earnings. And it will, whenever you reduce the earnings of a bank and you reduce the capital of a bank, you reduce its ability to lend into the economy.
Menzies says banks are stronger today compared to past crises.
In perspective to the years when we had 500 banks or 1,000 banks fail back in the 80s or the early 90s, the number of bank failures today is certainly nowhere near what occurred way back then.
All told, the nation's banks lost more than $3 billion between April and June. But Menzies says most of the country's 8,100 banks are still doing okay. Frank Langfitt, NPR News, Washington.
Men account for a staggering 3 out of every 4 jobs lost in this current recession. This means more households are relying on women to bring home the bacon, and that can mean an added economic burden. Here in our Washington studio to talk about this is Heather Boucher. She's a senior economist at the Center for American Progress. And we're also joined by Michael Kimmel. He's a sociology professor at the State University of New York, Stony Brook. Welcome to you both.
Thank you. It's great to be here.
Nice to be here. Thanks, Jennifer.
Heather, why are men absorbing the brunt of the job losses, and is this different from previous recessions?
Well, this recession has been different because men have lost so many of the jobs. They've lost 3 out of 4 jobs since the recession began back in December of 07. And the reason is because nearly half the jobs that have been lost in either construction or manufacturing. And these are places where men are the majority of employees. The industries which haven't seen job losses, like healthcare, are where women are the majority of employees.
So what does it mean when it's the man in the household who loses his job?
Well, in the typical American family, if it's a married couple, he brings home about 2/3 of the family's income. So if he loses his job, the family loses that larger earnings. It's also more likely for the family to get their health insurance from his job rather than her job. So when he loses his job, they're likely to be losing the larger wage earner, and they're likely to be losing their health insurance disproportionately relative to if the woman loses her job.
So not only you lose that income, the larger income, you then have to shell out more for health insurance. Michael, what are the social implications if you have this new wave of out-of-work men being supported by their wives?
Well, there's a couple of things about this. On the one hand, I mean, one of the ways in which this is certainly not the Great Depression or your father's depression, as it were, is that most of the men who are losing their jobs, their wives work. I mean, so it's not a single earner any longer. Although, you know, as Heather mentions, they're certainly bringing home more than half of the the aggregate paycheck. And that's the other thing. And the second thing is I don't see this a big crisis of masculinity brewing as a result of this, partly because the way that this recession has been framed, every time we talk about the catastrophic numbers, the drops in manufacturing, there's also simultaneously in the same article, the same news report, there's this discussion of recovery. So everybody assumes that the recovery is coming soon. Everyone assumes that this is a temporary kind of episodic experience, not an existential one.
But you know, my husband had a temporary episode where I was the breadwinner, and he didn't say much at the time, but I did find out afterwards it had an impact. I mean, it struck at his soul in a certain way when, you know, I had to give him spending money.
Right. And this is, I mean, and there is a sense that, you know, oh my gosh, this has to turn around. I have to find a job. I have to be able to do this in the future. But there is a general sense that it's going to happen.
Heather, the figures that you have mentioned are for the entire population. I'm wondering if this, the job loss is mainly among men. Is there any difference by race or ethnicity?
Well, what we've seen, you know, it is mostly among men, but unemployment, of course, has hit young workers, older workers harder. It's hit African-American and Hispanic families harder than white families. And it's hit workers with less education more so than workers with, you know, college or professional degrees. So it really is very disparate impacts depending on the different groups.
If you're just joining us, you're listening to Tell Me More from NPR News. I'm speaking with Heather Boucher and Michael Kimmel about how those losing jobs in this recession are disproportionately men. Michael, you said that you think that the recovery will come around soon enough. I'm wondering, you know, given that a lot of the losses have been in industries, as Heather said, dominated by men, are those industries going to pick up, or do you think men will find jobs elsewhere?
Well, it's a good question. I think both. It's not an either or. Both are true. The first thing I would say is, while this is not the most gendered economic downturn we've ever had, probably 90% of all the job losses in the Great Depression were jobs held by men. But that was a very different era. It is true that, you know, as you said, 75% of all the job losses have been jobs by men. But is this not also the most gendered recovery that you've ever seen? The whole stimulus package, or a very large part of the stimulus package, after all, are for shovel-ready jobs. Well, which gender do you think is holding the shovels? Which gender are going to be involved in all of the construction jobs and all of the infrastructure redevelopment and rehabilitation that's supposed to be part of the recovery package? It seems to me that both are true. It is absolutely the case that, you know, as Bruce Springsteen said, you know, the foreman says these jobs are going, boy, and they ain't coming back. And that's largely the case. On the other hand, there is going to be a dramatic government-sponsored stimulus to heavy industry, manufacturing, and construction that will be largely filled by men.
Well, Heather, you've written also that their job losses haven't stopped, and in fact, we may see more state and local governments cut jobs, and that would hit at...
That would hit at women. I mean, I think one of the things that we've seen is that because we've had continued gains in employment and healthcare, and we haven't seen the kind of job losses in education or in government that we've seen among other industries, women's jobs have been preserved so far. However, coming down the pipeline, we're seeing large budget cuts at the state and local level. You know, a lot of tax revenues are falling, both because of unemployment, but also because of the collapse of the housing bubble. And that's going to disproportionately impact women's jobs moving forward. And so that's certainly something to be watching for. You know, the stimulus package did spend a lot of money on those shovel-ready projects, but actually most of the money is going to tax cuts or is going to aid to the states, and that will certainly help preserve women's jobs, hopefully, moving forward.
Well, if at this point it's more men who are leaving the labor force, I'm wondering if there might be some supply and demand effect where we could see women's wages, which traditionally lag, if we could see them increase.
Perhaps. I think more likely we're going to see men, especially unemployed men who are having to retool or transition to a new kind of job, entering some of those more traditionally female occupations like nursing or education or jobs that they haven't held in such large numbers before. But that's an optimistic scenario. You know, it's worth noting that the period in time where we saw the biggest narrowing of the gender pay gap was when men's wages fell during the 1980s. We are likely to see that again.
Michael, what about men going into nursing and other traditionally female industries?
Well, you know, certainly men have always gone where the jobs are, and if that's where the job, and I think Heather's right that it may be the case that the first wave of great job losses have been in manufacturing and construction and heavy industry, and the second wave may be in administrative, clerical, sales, sort of jobs held by women in state and local governments, for example. But I think men have always gone where the jobs are. And And so if there are job openings, as we also know from the stimulus package, in education and healthcare, then more men are going to be entering in those positions at lower levels. I think that Heather's right that they will be entering at lower wage levels than they exited. And that does mean that the wage gap will shrink, but not because men, you know, because all the boats are rising, but rather the gap between the men's wages and women's wages will be, you know, declining as men's wages go down.
Michael, you're a sociologist. I'm wondering if you see some positive side, a silver lining, if you will, to this phenomenon of mainly men losing jobs thus far.
It's hard to say that there's a positive outcome for all this job loss. And certainly, you know, I don't think that we see any colossal deliberate redefinition of the ideology of masculinity based on this. But I do think that the major impact in families across the country is that everybody assumes that women and men will be working outside the home. And that is going to be, the assumption, not just the question whether or not she should work, but the ideology that, you know, my students, for example, traditionally aged college students, they assume both partners are going to work outside the home. They assume that the old 1950s model or their grandfather's, you know, depression model is not going to hold for them.
Heather, very quickly, any silver lining to this trend of men losing most of the jobs?
Well, I think it's making families reevaluate, you know, whose job is more important and how they're going to together make ends meet.
Economist Heather Boucher is with the Center for American Progress. We also heard from Professor Michael Kimmel, who was very kind and interrupted his vacation to join us by phone from Massachusetts. Thanks to both of you.
Thank you, Jennifer.
President Obama has asked Ben Bernanke to stay on as chairman of the Federal Reserve. And if the Senate goes along, Bernanke will have another 4 years to help manage the country's economy. To talk about the challenges he would face, we call David Wessel. He's economics editor of The Wall Street Journal, a frequent guest on this program, and joins us now. Good morning.
Good morning, Renee.
The economy looks like it might be possibly improving, certainly stabilizing. What would Bernanke focus on were he to stay on as Fed chair?
Well, your forecast is a good one. It's pretty much the one that Ben Bernanke himself has made. His problem now is to decide when is the right moment for him to raise interest rates and pull back some of this credit that he has injected in the economy during the crisis. If he moves too soon, he risks pushing the economy back into recession. That's something that the Fed did back in 1937 during the Great Depression. He doesn't want to do that. But if he waits too long, he risks an outbreak of inflation that he has vowed to avoid. He also has, I think, a big challenge in maintaining the Fed's independence to make that decision. He's under a lot of criticism from Congress. It's a real vote of affirmation from the president, of course, that he's being reappointed. But he needs to keep good relations with Congress and defend the Fed to the public so the Fed has the independence that he so greatly values.
And the White House just came out with new projections on the federal deficits, $9 trillion over the next decade, enormous deficits if you go along with this, the estimate. That's got to be something that people are thinking about. How would Bernanke deal with that?
Right. It's something that Bernanke really cannot avoid worrying about. For one thing, the global investors now seem willing to lend the U.S. government enormous amounts of money at relatively low interest rates. This year's deficit is going to be higher as a fraction of all the goods and services we produce in the U.S. than at any time since World War II. As long as the foreign investors keep coming, that's great. If they get sated, Mr. Bernanke may have to cope with the fact that long-term interest rates, which is what they charge us for lending us money, could rise, and that could hurt the economy when it's still weak. Or it could push down the value of the dollar, which could lead to inflation and could lead Mr. Bernanke to raise interest rates prematurely. Or it could provide a lot of juice for the economy. If things start to come back, he may find that he has to raise rates to slow the economy because there's so much fiscal policy pushing it along.
Is it all about reacting, though, for Bernanke? I mean, does he have any influence over the deficits?
Well, you know, that's a good question. He doesn't directly, of course. Deficits are about taxes and spending. That's the province of the president and the Congress. But in the past, the Fed chairman, especially one who's got a little bit of credibility, has had an enormous amount of influence on Congress. If he goes up there and testifies in his second term as Fed chairman that you guys really need to do something about this, or if he helps maybe influence the tone of the political debate and says you can't avoid this, that in the past with Alan Greenspan or with Paul Volcker has had an influence, and I suspect that'll happen again.
And David, what do you make of the $9 trillion estimate of future deficits? Is that on the money? Is it an underestimation?
Well, none of us are very good at forecasting 10 years out, but it could be an underestimate. It depends on guessing what's going to happen to health care costs. It depends on what decisions Congress makes on taxes and spending. And importantly, it depends on what happens to the economy. If we get an oil price increase or a turn in the stock market or more problems in commercial real estate and the economy gets worse, then that reduces the amount of revenues to the government, increases the amount of spending, and could make this even enormous number look like an underestimate.
David, thanks very much.
You're welcome.
David Wessel is economics editor of The Wall Street Journal.